Okay, here we are. That's how I start all my shows.
You know what?
That's a great way to start.
I'm not going to say who you are. I want to see people to get a sense, if they can get a sense of who you are.
What's my line?
What's my line?
Yeah, well, just...
Are you a plumber?
Is your product found in the home? Is the product found up your ass?
Have you ever buried a body somewhere?
Yes, I have.
Do you remember this show called David Susskind? You remember that
guy?
Sure. He had a show. I'm talking with Paul Reiser.
Hello.
Emmy and Golden Globe nominated actor.
Oh my gosh.
Co-creator of Mad About You, which won 12 Emmy Awards.
You've done your homework. I wouldn't have had any of that.
I've watched that show, and I wasn't thinking Emmy Awards. No, I'm just kidding. Three best-selling books, a music prodigy.
Prodigy. Generous word.
I was very depressed after reading about you. I feel like I've accomplished nothing.
Oh, you know what? It's all publicity. I've done none of those things.
Did you bring me a cigar? I like cigars. You didn't ask if I wanted a cigar.
Let me finish.
No, I'm just
kidding. That's why it stopped. I brought stopped to pick you up some. That's why I was a little tardy. You can't tell when this is being aired. It's not aired. What do you call this? When this is being
posted.
Posted. It's missed.
Yes.
It's when this is sprayed into the essence of America. You won't know that I was tardy, but
no,
I apologize.
And you have Nina is great. By
Nina
the way.
is the young woman who makes sure that I
very
go the
thorough.
Right place. Oh, she's remarkably thorough.
A lot of back and forth. Had some negative things to say about you, but I will not show you those.
You
emails.
Know what? She's honest, and I appreciate that.
Well, thank you for doing the show.
So far, it's not bad.
What was that line when you did the Tonight Show in 82? It's like, what do you say we skip this and I'll go for coffee?
Somebody told me.
That was the ballsiest way to start.
Who was you?
This guy does national television spot that everybody's waiting for. He's like, fuck it, let's go.
I'm happy to skip it. It's funny. That was just sort of my own comfort zone, something I said to make myself comfortable. But the truth is, I always felt that way, and I still feel that way about stand-up, that it's not that important. What I'm going to do here is not necessary.
Yeah.
So if there's any resistance, absolutely, let's just stop it right now.
But you also said that
because you think it's a ballsy thing. I'm going to stand here and say things that I think are funny to entertain you.
And you don't know me, and I've never
you don't
met
know
you.
Me,
and I need you to laugh at me though.
Yeah, I need your participation. If you'd rather not. Let's just call it a day.
I understand. So every when you were working clubs, would you wait like 5 minutes for people to leave after that? Just say, okay, do we have the people that really want to be here now?
Exactly. I would weed out the riffraff. I want the people who are determined.
But related to that, you did say, I never like to come out and just do material. I like to connect. Let's talk. Let's just be here. So,
where did I say that?
Did I say that? Yes, you said it. So it's funny. I was aiming to just sort of be in that moment and diminish expectations, but
that's what I said.
But yes, you did. But this idea of I never like to come out and just do material.
Diminished
I like to
expectations. That's like Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't get too excited.
Oh, by the way, Stu Trivak says hello.
I bet you he said it funny.
Yeah, tell him I said hello.
Stu's a funny guy.
There's a great picture of you, Stu Trivak, and Joey Vega still up at the comic strip.
That's
next funny. To. Lucien Holt, was he there?
Lucien
Holt,
yes. Lucien was the very efficient manager of the comic strip, and he was the gatekeeper, so you couldn't get on stage.
Yes, he was.
Lucien said, I think we can put you on at 2:40 in the morning.
Yeah, exactly, and he had a very condescending way of talking.
That's very supercilious.
And I remember one time he said to me, you know, you're funny on stage, but sometimes you're trying too hard to be funny off stage. I'm like, really, you're critiquing how I exist? Off stage now?
That's not good.
But this idea that going on and just starting to do jokes feels not natural is something that I feel is the same way. Like it just, sometimes even just for a second to be able to go up, you know, in the clubs obviously, and just say, hello, you know, say something to somebody down front just seems more natural to me.
Yeah, well, but you need that connection because the whole premise is I'm going to talk and we're going to relate.
Right.
And especially in the comedy clubs, when you come up one after the other, you sort of need to define your terms a bit and let them, you know, take a moment and tune in to that frequency. Because, but there are some people who Well, I'll say some people who don't do that because they have such a strong persona. You know, you picture like, you know, Stephen Wright,
right,
who doesn't do any talking, right, but standing there and staring at you and being silent,
right,
that's his thing. It's like,
right,
oh, okay, this is what channel he's on. Well, let's dial it in. Oh, and he speaks very slowly and soft. Okay. And then you get into that. And some guys are,
yeah,
come out and grab you by the lapels and shake you around. And everybody has their particular thing. And, when, you know, it's funny. People, often people who are not very savvy in comedy or interviewers will say, you ever bomb? Did you ever bomb? And I, you know, of course you do. Mm-hmm. But to me, those two things are related. I don't think you ever really bomb. The only way you really bomb is if you just don't make that connection.
Right.
Because you can connect, and then you can do material that may or may not work, but they'll still go, okay,
right,
you tried. We understand who you are and what, right, you're trying for. The only time they sit there and go, this guy is terrible, right, is if he doesn't know it and you haven't made that connection. So to me, it is, you know, it's not incidental. Your relationship with that audience is,
right,
kind of key.
I also think bombing is a byproduct of your intention as the artist and what you want. Like, there, I know some guys that they're bombing. You know, you're listening to the audience. It's different than acting. And by the way, in Aliens, you're great. You're a really good actor.
Am I still in that?
Yeah.
I haven't seen it in a while.
Well, you got cut out. I got
right,
the DVD.
Yeah, after a couple of years, it's kind of my, it's my, like, scene's dissolved.
Yeah, there's,
it's self-destruct.
There's a hologram of Leonardo DiCaprio. It's a,
all right.
It's a, and
well, I saw Avatar, where I was replaced by Giovanni Ribisi.
Yeah, there you go. But where did those act? I know you and at SUNY Binghamton, you studied music and specifically piano composition. Where did the acting, and I know in, I think in high school you were sort of checking out George Carlin albums,
yeah,
and reciting.
The acting, you know, it's funny. I as a kid, I never wanted to be an actor. I never was like a student of plays or theater, but there is something about a performance, you know, and so you'd be in a school play because you didn't have comedy clubs in seventh,
right,
grade. So you get in the school play and you can get some laughs, or you can, and it was never, and it was always about that. It was,
yeah,
let me be funny, let me be, you know, the tumbler.
Would you watch the comics on the Tonight Show?
Yeah.
That was the one thing I'd always ask my parents, let me stay up late to
always
watch.
Always.
And what really connected with me was this thing you said about George Carlin. You would memorize some of his bits and then do them. And I would do that. Like, I'd see Rodney,
yeah,
and then I'd go in at the locker room in my,
yeah,
high school.
Yeah.
And my wife and I went to high school, and she remembers it. And I would just be doing Rodney. And,
sure,
I'd tell people it was Rodney, but I was like, wow, they're laughing at me. This is awesome.
It's, yeah, great. Where'd you go to high school? Where'd you grow up?
Providence, Rhode Island.
Rhode Island.
We went to high school together. We met on a ski trip.
That's and, so funny.
Yeah. Well, you know, look at me. Who could turn me down?
Listen,
would you let me get away?
No. Are you kidding? That's why I got here as soon as I saw the picture.
But sorry, you were saying, so that seventh grade.
I would even before that, at like Ed Sullivan show, you know, I would, other than the Beatles, which was, I don't remember watching that before the Beatles, but afterwards, you know, you'd watch, the occasional cool band would be on, surprisingly, but then you'd watch comics. So it was, and sometimes it was like pre hippy dippy George Carlin, and
right,
there was Robert Klein and Rodney for sure, and a lot of the old school guys, Alan King and Jack Carter and Jackie Mason,
yeah,
until he wasn't invited back. But I loved those guys. And as a kid, I was drawn to them and I loved them, but I didn't have any conscious thought of, I want to do that. Nor did I even know that you could do that. I wouldn't know how.
Exactly,
I
think, the right? Same thing with me.
You're kind of like, well, you don't know. You know,
my father put floors in for a living.
You don't think as a 10-year-old, I don't know, most people, I don't think, know what they want to be or even have that thought of, am I supposed to pick a major?
Right,
you know,
exactly.
I'm seven.
Yeah.
But there's a proclivity towards things. Though it's interesting, you know, my kids are 20 and 15, and my 15-year-old leans towards comedy, and he's very funny, and he's really savvy about movies and stuff. And I think, well, you don't have to think about a career. But when I think about it, I look back somewhere between 15 and 20, which is a short 5 years.
Yeah.
In my experience, I kind of got formed, and I went, and in college I sort of did some plays that were comedies and silly musicals, and I would always want to do the comedies and be the funny guy. And that, on a parallel track, was watching comedians. And then suddenly, because there were these clubs were opening at that right in that moment in history,
in the
improv,
70s.
Yeah, the early 70s, Catch a Rising Star and comic
did Rick Newman own Catch a Rising Star at the time?
Yeah. So that was a place to go. So suddenly there were breadcrumbs leading to go here, and all will be revealed.
So what I was trying to figure out in reading about you is, so then why the music, and I don't mean that in a pejorative way, but
it was, there was no connection. I mean, I played piano as a kid, and I was okay. I wasn't like a
you're
guy.
Good. There's an Anita Baker
video okay. I can
on
play.
YouTube that people should see that playing Mad About You theme.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, she did the revamped version of the Mad About You theme song. She was pretty cool. Yeah.
And, you have the rhythm of a white man, but you're still good the way you move behind
she said, my favorite compliment, which was just kind of mumbled, but I have it framed in my head, and we were playing it, and somebody was saying, like, you know, maybe you should pull. When we recorded that, she was actually, I don't know if she was in Detroit or she was in New York, I was in L.A., and you can, you know, actually record together thousands of miles apart. They have the technology. So... And she was just on headphones, and somebody in the studio said, maybe Paul, you should play a little less. And she said, no, he's kicking my ass exactly where I needed to be kicked. I went, wow. I am apparently kicking Anita's ass.
Okay, now I know nothing about music.
And it's all about kicking the ass.
Explain to people listening who don't either what that means, in that parlance means in terms of...
I don't know. It just sounded cool.
Oh, yeah. All right.
I don't know. You know, I was sort of, I don't know, I guess playing
in a, rhythm
in a little offbeat, and it was a cool, funky, and we had a great band. We had, you know, Jim Keltner on drums and a lot of guys from Bonnie Raitt's band. It was these top-notch musicians that Don was, who co-wrote the song with me. And he produced it. So he gathered these guys in a heartbeat. And I went, so the guy who played behind John Lennon and George Harrison is on drums here, Jim Keltner? And Billy Preston played the organ on that? It was crazy. He actually came in separate. I didn't get to meet him. He came in and recorded later. But I don't know. It was just a cool thing, like, that whatever it is I was doing, she was going, yeah, that's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
I said, well, okay, this is a good day.
So the music thing was nothing.
I was not planning.
But something drew you to music. That's when you pick a major of anything, something, was it your parent? Was it something in your family?
It's interesting. It was a little bit lazy because I played piano and I said, well, there was somewhat of a piano program. There was a really cool piano teacher at Binghamton who I'm still really good friends with. And, so I became a major because I don't think I got admitted because of that, but it was like a little extra credit thing. It was like, we'll consider like the bathing suit competition. Like, well, he also sings, so that'll help. He had mediocre grades, but he has some promise in music. So, but it also, because I play piano, so I was sort of halfway done with the degree. If you just do all the music courses, I went, all right, then I'll just major in that. And I was sort of halfway home. So, but I don't think... I don't remember, but I don't think I was planning to make a career of it. I wasn't, you know, that kind of chops that you need to be a piano guy.
But did you, so once those breadcrumbs started to get laid out for you in the city and you started going to those clubs, did you, I remember Jay Leno, who I had on the show, talked about the green, what's the place, there was a place. The Green Kitchen, he would hang out there. Did you guys hang out there and kind of?
Yeah, it was after the show.
And so it'd be like you and Seinfeld.
Seinfeld, Larry Miller, Mark Schiff, Joe Bolster, Dennis Wolfberg.
I had Larry Miller on. He tells this hilarious story where they made him bartend one night at the comic strip and he had no idea what to do. So people were ordering like complicated mixed drinks and he was just giving everybody like fucking Bud Light bottles.
Sure.
Like and then
here you go.
And the people would, the waitress would come back and he goes, and the people would take them. Like they wouldn't bitch.
Fine.
Like,
yeah, you don't want to rest because they had a big bouncer there.
Right.
Yeah, you know, and we were, what, 20, 22, 23, 24. So, and all of us were kind of living this dream that I don't think we anticipated, but here we are living in the city in our own little crappy apartment, making a living, you know, not much, but we were making, you know, a couple of $100 a week between assorted gigs.
They pay you $25 or $30 a spot here in the city now.
It wasn't then.
$75 or $80 on the weekends, which is...
No, it wasn't even then. I think it was nothing in the beginning. And then after a few years, it would get, you know, $5 or $10, but then you'd get a, you know, $75 gig out in Jersey.
At a country club.
Yeah, here's 40 and you cobble it together and go, I just made $240.
And you feel like you're in showbiz.
Rent was $11. So, but it was more than that. I mean, so yes, we were all thrilled that we didn't have to have regular jobs.
Yeah.
And but the real joy was the camaraderie that you get to hang out with like-minded people. Mm-hmm. So here are these people that suddenly became, you know, brothers and sisters. Like, well,
who are living in a world only they could understand.
Yeah. And there was nothing. I remember I miss this part. But you know, when you get together with other comics, you're dialed in to a specific frequency. And I remember one time, this was after the beginning years. This is probably like maybe 15, 20 years ago. But I was Miller and Seinfeld and Schiff and I went out to lunch or something in L.A. I don't know, but we were just jamming and spritzing and making each other laugh. And then something came up and we all just instinctively did our line on it, our take on it. And then we stopped and went, do you realize what we just did? We each had our interpretation. It's like, here's a theme and here's how this saxophone player did it, has this guy. And we all did our particular things. And it was kind of, and a layman couldn't jump into that conversation.
No, it's in your DNA.
Yeah.
I think it's in your DNA and it's formed going back to 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, watching these shows. There's something about that.
And it was an appreciation. It was never competitive. It wasn't trying to top. It wasn't, you know, if anything, it was supportive. You know, but when you were just hanging out and laughing, you'd make each other laugh in a way that dentists don't.
If you have the right laughing gas, then this can be really
good. Yeah, that's true.
Were you guys helping each other with bits?
All the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was instinctive. You wouldn't even think about it. You just go, oh, that's a great bit. You know, by the way, you know, you mentioned that thing before. Maybe you can tie that into that other piece. Yeah. Oh, that's a great idea. Then, of course, the next day you go, what was that? What did you tell me yesterday? I don't freaking remember.
When did you, and we're going to talk about Matt about you in a minute, and
there's no rush, it's off the air, take your time. It's DVD, go buy the DVD.
When did you become conscious of, well, I got to have, not just be funny, but kind of have a voice, like who am I? Like the idea, we were talking earlier about going on stage and just, there's certain acts, they're ripe for just going into their act like a Stephen Wright. Yours is not. I don't think mine is. It tends to be conversational and personal, which is a spine that goes to Matt About You, right? Because Matt About You is a very relatable
and it was the extension of that. I mean, that Matt About You literally grew out of my stand-up because my stand-up at that time it was 92, so I wrote it in 91. So it was my stand-up at that time. My wife, who we were not married yet, but she had just moved out to L.A. No, we were married by that point. And I was doing stuff in my act about relationships and how things are different when you're living. Suddenly, you know, you live by yourself and suddenly you're living with a woman. And then suddenly you're married and how things change. And that stuff was just coming more naturally to me. And so it was more organic, but it was also funnier. So,
and you put it in a great way, by the way. Somewhere I read you say it's, you're at a party with your wife, and then it's that conversation in the cab on the way home. Wasn't that guy
right? That was the pit. Yeah, that was the idea that we pitched it.
And Warren Littlefield talks about it in his book. And it's brilliant in its simplicity. Like, some of the best ideas are right beneath the surface. And you're right. Like those, I had it last night. Like, I went home, and I was at a club working out a set that I'm going to be doing, and I went off on something with my wife, like, and it's that conversation.
And those bits are always going to be richer and deeper because people will relate to it, and it's personal. So you're talking about something. You know, I always tell people when I do my act and I'm talking about an argument that I had with my wife, and I'll just literally repeat the argument, and it'll get great laughs. And it's not because I'm such a genius, but they're laughing because, like, holy shit, I just had the same fight yesterday with my wife.
And how great is that feeling?
It's great.
I'm doing a bit now. I don't look for anything, right? And it drives my wife crazy. So we have this conversation, which is almost verbatim, of, like, I'm in the refrigerator looking for the jar of pickles, and she's in the living room, and she won't come in and show me because I'm going to...
How else are you going to learn?
Yeah, are you looking? Yeah. Are you looking or just looking? And it's this whole...
It's great.
And it's 2 minutes, and it crushes. And you know out of the gates, because the minute I set up the premise...
Yes.
50% of the heads are nodding, or they're elbowing each other, pointing at the other spouse, going, "He does that," or
"Yes,
she does that."
There is, and Matt About You was sort of a festival of that. You know, we would all come in with moments and stories not even deliberately trying to come up with an episode, but we would just all
I was wondering unload. About that. Raymond, everybody loves Raymond. Ray Romano says every Monday the assignment was you come in from the weekend, talk about what happened, and maybe would you kind of loosely
absolutely.
Do that?
Carl Reiner used to talks about that still, how Dick Van Dyke, you know, the writers would sit like, what did you do? What did you guys have for dinner? And suddenly the stories come up and go, okay, that's really funny. And so Mad About You, that was the essence of it. It was this very relatable thing. We weren't trying to, say, what would everybody relate to? But you just, the stuff that you find funny, you're not alone. And everybody else will find funny. There's one particular moment in Mad About You, you know, whatever, 7 years. And there was one little teaser that we did, you know, these little 20-second, 30-second standalones before the show. And those were fun because they didn't have to be stories. You could just do a moment. Mm. And there was one that really everybody, strangers will come over and tell me that they loved, which was I'm sitting watching TV, minding my own business, and Helen Hunt, the wife, comes in with the empty toilet roll paper in one hand and the holder in the other hand and just demonstrates.
Oh, I remember that.
That's, you know, without saying a word. There's not a word. It just goes, this is how it's done, idiot.
Yeah.
Okay, put the new paper on when you're finished. And never saw that before. Nobody ever talked. It's so small,
right.
But it resonated with so many people. And that was always the most. Those were the best moments for us when we go, okay, where people are responding because we hit it on the head there.
Yeah. Well, you've talked about the smaller moments, and as the show went on, and I think the great thing about the show, and it's out. All the seasons are out. Apparently, you guys lost season 6 or 7.
We didn't lose them. You know,
I don't understand this. Can you explain this to me?
I didn't know it. I didn't know it until, ironically, till a couple of years ago when I started doing stand-up again, and I'd go out to, you know, clubs and theaters and doing little, you know, meet and greets with the audience afterwards, and invariably people say, "How come I can't get season 6 and 7?" The last, I said, "What do you mean? I didn't know that." And I started calling, and I would call Sony, who produced the show, and it took a while to get an answer. And they said, "Yeah, that's true. There is a problem." I went, "What do you mean?" And apparently it was something, a music clearance. And I went, "What music? We didn't have music." And then I didn't think about it, but anytime if you walk by, you know, you walk from the bedroom to the kitchen singing Wooly Bully, that's $4,000. you're humming something from The King and I, that's $1,200. So you add it up, and it was like a gazillion dollars.
And who doesn't hum The King and I when you're walking around half naked in your apartment?
That's right. And so all those things added up. And it's, I said, well, you can't not.
Did they not want to pay the clearance?
No, it's just, you know what? And I knew enough to not take it personally. It wasn't like they go, we're not making the effort to get these shows out. It's just, it's you know, it's a 20-year-old show. They're on to other things. It's not on their mind.
Right.
And my take was, we all work really hard.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, a big piece of all of our lives. So the idea that unless we do something, this is just going to be lost to posterity for silly legal stuff.
Yeah.
There's got to be a way. And it was actually an uphill climb and had a whole bunch of meetings with a lot of lawyers
really?
And people at Sony. And to their credit, they weren't resisting. They were just going, whew, that's going to be, it's like a labyrinth. You know, it's sort of like the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark where there's miles and miles of archives.
Right.
Each little thing has its own little trail, and you have to call that publisher. And so they did some wonderful, miraculous thing where they made a big deal. You know, I'll tell you what, we owe you 100 gazillion. We'll give you 80 gazillion. And they went, great, all right, we'll take it.
All right.
And it wasn't just Mad About You. It turns out there were a bunch of shows that's just what happens. But unless you actually squeak the wheel, it ain't gonna happen. So it was a very pure interaction. It was literally fans of the show saying to me, "Can you do something about it?" I said, "I don't know. I'll try."
Tremendous.
And I actually just met with other people who went, "Yeah, I guess. Okay, sure. If you're going to really stay honest, I guess we can do that." And so it was very encouraging in a larger sense to know that, you know what, if you squeak loud enough, things can change.
I could see that conversation. It's fucking Riser again online, too.
So today, Mad About You DVDs. Tomorrow, World Peace.
There
it can happen.
You
just got to.
We're going to need you with Trump in the White House.
Believe
We're going to need you to set. So you said about Mad About You, what made it work was, in fact, it wasn't so unique. Everyone can say, oh, I've had that argument.
Exactly.
I've had that issue.
Yeah.
I've had that fight. I've had that moment. And this is the part that really fascinates me. And we did blur the lines. And what do you mean by blur the lines?
I have no idea. What do I mean? I was about to say, what does it have? Blur the, I don't know. I was younger when I said
it. Okay, here's what you meant by it. I think what you meant by it is one of the things that I always admired about the show was you didn't go down the easy road, the hacky road. In other words, like it didn't start to become like, whoa, we've got this crazy situation and Jamie and Paul have to get out of it. It was always about the relationship.
Right.
And then that quirky thing that happened was born out of that relationship,
right,
as opposed to the inverse. And I think that that's why it sustained. And then you've also talked about wanting to go small. You know, I want to do an episode of the show where we can't leave the house. We can't get out of bed. You were interested as you were going along in smaller and smaller moments.
Well, I have to say, even in the beginning, that was the intention. And I remember very clearly when I approached Helen. I met Helen Hunt because she was a friend. She and my wife had a mutual friend. And they had a dinner party one night, and I met her. This is just when we were writing the pilot, and I had, you know, I knew her from some movies, TV movies and stuff. And so we left, and I said to my wife, I said, she would be great. What do you think about her as you? And she went, my wife said, she'd be great.
Now, what was it as the casting director in you that thought she would play well opposite me? Because she's perfect.
Well, right? She was just... Well, she was, you know, beautiful without being, you know, distractingly beautiful. She was just like, well, that's a lovely woman.
Yeah.
She was funny.
Yeah.
She was really smart. She was quirky.
Could keep you in line.
She was neurotic enough. Yeah, she was certainly strong and yet at the same time, goofy enough and, you know, with flaws aplenty.
Yeah.
And that was the other sort of...
So you weren't going to get a one-note performance out of it.
Yeah, and we always wanted it to be... it wasn't the odd couple. It wasn't, you know, he's neat, she's sloppy, or she's whatever it is. It was in life, you know, sometimes, you know, one partner has to keep the other in line, and then 10 minutes later, it's the other one. Like, okay, I got this. Calm down. We got it. But I remember when I sent her the script, and she was kind of not wanting to do TV, but she responded to the script, and she came over to my house to talk about it. And in that first meeting, before we had even shot the pilot, I said, well, here's the kind of things I'd like to do. And tell me if, you know, whatever, for what, if it appeals to you or it doesn't, let me know. But I said, I want to do where they're just reading the Sunday paper and they don't leave the house. I want to do an episode where it's just the two of them talking for a whole episode. You know, just maybe it's the two of them in bed, there's a conversation. So by design, it was always meant to be small. And it was funny, years after the show was over, I was cleaning out a closet and I found this journal that I had was keeping before the show, when we were just working on ideas for the show.
And now, like, this is at the point the show's been picked up?
The show hadn't been picked, yes. Or I think I was just writing the script. Or maybe that we did the pilot, like, what would you want to do? And as I opened it, I was a little nervous. I went, oh, I really hope... I'm going to be really upset if I see he has 12 things I hoped to do and never did. And to my delight, everything was checked off. I went,
really?
Did it. So we did a show, like a third or fourth episode of the first season was a show called Sunday Times, where we just couldn't manage to get out the door. And it was like, you know, it was a very tight little show. And it was a challenge. It was a really well-written episode. I think Jeffrey Lane wrote that script. And you still need story and drama, like, okay, I forgot something, she forgot something. Then we go downstairs, up, there's a parade, we can't, the street's blocked off. Then something else happens with the dog, whatever it is. Like, how hard is it to get out the house? Oh,
right,
my God.
Right.
But it's doable. And then it wasn't until the seventh season we finally did, one of my favorite episodes was called The Conversation, and it was one continuous take, no cuts.
This is the one you talked about in your head that you had wanted to do.
And we never found a great story that would support the two of them just talking, because it could be indulgent. Just, you know,
no cuts.
But so it was, if you make a mistake on the 1 yard line, you got to start over. So you can't cut away to something else. But we could write a half an hour of funny dialogue, but it becomes indulgent unless you have a story. And we finally, in the, the 66th year, we had a baby. So in the seventh season, we said, what about if we're trying to get the baby to teach herself to cry herself to sleep?
Which my wife and I had to do.
Right? And it was a really powerful story. So we were sitting outside
Meaning, for people listening, not going into the room.
Right. So go in and there's being
disciplined and staying in your
bed. And there is what they call ferberizing. There's a doctor who had this thing. Like you go in after 60 seconds, then you wait for 2 minutes. Mm. Then you go in, don't touch them. So there's a whole format. And so they were trying to be responsible parents. Okay, we're going to do it. But you're hearing your child cry and not going in. It's really, really tough. And so then you have to distract yourself. Okay, let's talk about, don't even think about the baby. Don't think, let's talk. And you sit there sitting on the floor, two idiots. And we're on the floor and we're noticing, I never knew there was a cabinet here. And then you open a cabinet and you're so it was really just the two of them talking.
And that baby thing is critical because if it's not there to take you, the viewer needs somewhere else to go.
Something of import.
Out of that room.
Yeah. And so, and it ended up, there was a whole comedy thing with the dog. We left the dog in the room. We got to get the dog out, but without waking the baby. And so then the dog has to get the take, right? And that was another nightmare, but it was perfect. And it was a really beautiful episode and ultimately really moving because the end, I'm not going to ruin it because people have seen it. It's been years. But at the end, we succeeded. The baby actually cried herself to sleep, and it was a victory, but we both were like, just broke our hearts. Like, now what the baby just learned is we're not going to always be there for her. Like, what have we done?
Yeah, but you tapped into life.
Yeah,
like, you tapped into...
People related to that very intensely.
You know, so that it's nothing, it's never a neat bow, you know? I remember my wife was much more disciplined with that. Like, I would just want to go,
sure.
No, don't.
Yes.
Plus, she was breastfeeding. It's like, I don't need the aggravation.
Yeah.
She wanted to eat again, all that stuff. It was... brutally, brutally hard.
One of the things one of the other things we tried to do as best we could was to never make this a perfect couple. People, they're such a terrific couple. But we, yes, it's a half hour and it's a comedy. That's our job, to entertain. But it was also, I think the things that people remember most were probably not the funniest, but the most touching and the most, relatable. And we always made sure to make this couple struggle. So
in terms of
they have problems. Yeah. So they're not just lovey-dovey because that's nauseating.
Right.
So they do love each other, but then there was this period when they were trying to have a baby and they couldn't.
Right.
So let's not make it easy for them. And then so it's like, well, who's got the biological problem? Is it his problem? Is it her problem? And that takes you down. And so, my character was questioning his manhood and she was questioning her womanhood.
Yeah.
And that was the season that we finally got to do another thing that we set out in that first meeting was the infidelity. It's like, well, we'll put, do they actually have an affair? That might be a little brutal to watch, but maybe they're pretty tempted. It's like, because you can't have a marriage.
I remember that.
And people, I remember the head of NBC at the time when we sent them that script and they said, you can't have an affair. What was the word? He said, you're committing telecide. I said, okay, you know, that's not a thing. There is no, and they said, you can't, everybody loves Paul and Jamie. You can't have, I said, well, they're not going to break up.
Mm.
And they're probably, and we kept watering it down. So they didn't, neither of them actually had a full out affair, but they were tempted. They kissed, they held, they lied a little bit to each other. And that you can't have a show about a relationship where that doesn't rear its head.
Right.
And so they had trouble having the kid. And then when they had the kid, they struggled. We had a really funny episode where she had postpartum depression and she was just inconsolable. And I was inconsolable. It's like, okay, I got a lunatic here. what do you do? And those were real problems that we had to, not that we had to address, but it was great fertile ground, and it made the show richer.
Well, it's funny, my wife, we have a son, and we were trying to have another one. And first of all, people told me you have to have sex for that to happen, so that was part of the problem. But no, she got diagnosed with an irregular heartbeat, atrial fibrillation. So the doctor said, why are we trying to have a second kid? You could try to have a second kid, but it's very dangerous. She could go into stroke.
Mm.
And I remember sitting there, the two of us are on one side of the desk, and the doctor goes, she could go into stroke during labor. And I go, what's the chance of that? He goes, 3%. I go, that's not so bad. And she looked at me like, what are you, an asshole? And I'm like, well, instinctively.
You could have said 90%. Yeah,
exactly.
That's
bad. If I cross the street 100 times and I get hit by a bus 3 times, I take the odds. And it's funny what happened was, and I've never seen this addressed, and maybe it has, and I haven't seen it yet, but I felt that we were only have one kid. That's it. We got one kid. And I felt like we were broken, that there was something wrong with us.
Right.
And I know that that's tied to the 2.2 kids and the white picket fence and the whole nine yards. And my wife was like, look, it's going to be... Then the second phase of worry for me was like, he's going to be a lonely kid and blah, 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 and this and that. And it was a really kind of fucked up time for me, more so for me than for her.
It's interesting because these are things that you're not even aware of having these beliefs or thoughts. Like, I don't remember ever, you know, as a younger guy thinking, have to have kids. It was just, but it was in there. And then, and you have all kinds of concerns that when they come up, and then that was, you know, the show was a great platform to work on these issues and to talk about it and to find the comedy and to find the tenderness. And I think what I'm most proud of in that show, then, and it does hold up, is that it was really funny and it was as real, you know, as we could make it. And it was tender and was touching. And at the core, with the real, if you had to say, you know, the Beatles always said, McCartney said, I know you've had him on the show. when he was talking to, like, if you had to summarize the Beatles, it comes down to all, you know, in the end, the love you take is equal to the love you make.
Right.
And all you need is love. So that's it. If you want to really condense it.
Right.
And in Mad About You, our mission statement or whatever was, it's really hard to have a successful relationship. It's not just all circus and parades and fun and sex and you know, and wine and, and parties. There's a lot of work. And many, many times you're going to have a moment where you go, Jesus, this is, I don't know if this is worth it. This is really freaking hard.
Right.
And when you push through that, then there is fruit on the other side of that. You know, the theme song, going back to it, was called The Final Frontier. Because, like, yeah, sometimes the greatest distance in the world is between, you know, two people lying next to each other in bed. And you could be miles and universes apart.
Yeah.
Like, and how do you get across that distance? And it's never easy, but it is often worth it.
Yeah.
Not always. I mean, there are people that want to go, hey, you know what? You guys should walk away. This is somebody's going to get hurt here.
My father passed away. My parents, you know, they worked together in a small furniture store, so they were constantly around each other. And toward the end, they were fighting, like, all the time. And I remember one time saying to my sister, I was, like, 12, like, you think Mommy and Dad are going to get divorced? And she goes, no. But I remember that conversation, and it's like, I think subconsciously I was probably thinking, why do these people just get divorced? Yeah. It's like, I'm the third of three. I'll be okay with it. But some people stick it out. I think that generation.
Yes. But there is something to be said for it. It's easy. You know, who doesn't want to walk away? Who doesn't want to say, you know, fuck it, this is too hard.
Yeah.
And who doesn't, you know, notice other attractive people? But what's the cost? What are you willing to sacrifice? What are you willing to do? It's funny. We had one episode early on, second or third season maybe, where the character played my father, Louis Zurich, who was a just wonderful, funny, joyful guy. I saw him not long ago. He came to a show in New Jersey, and I love him. He's a great guy. But we did an episode where he had a minor heart attack, and so we all go to the hospital, and it was a very... It's a whole new thing. The family at the hospital, and everybody's loud, and everybody is worried. And like, and his question is, "Where did you park?" It's like, "Pop, you just don't worry about it. Did you park? Did you validate, Dad?" Don't. And then we see the mother sort of aggravating him, and he's hooked up to the heart machine, and he's doing fine. He's doing fine. And every time the mother comes in the room, we notice his heart thing is beeping, 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 and we go, "Oh my God, she's killing him!" And then we realize, no, she's keeping him alive. She's that frequency, even through the fighting and the loud, you know, love, tough love, whatever. That's that frequency worked for them. So sometimes it looks to the outsider, even to a kid, about his own parents, oh man, these people are going to kill each other. They go, no, they're actually...
But that's the sophistication in the writing of the show, is like a lot of shows would go broad and go, yeah, you know, the husband's a pain in the ass.
No, we always avoided that. And we always, you know, we never would badmouth each other. Characters would never badmouth each other unless there was a consequence or you know, or they would own it. But, you know, to me... You know, there were little moments, and then we would find in the playing, you know, you just walk by. It has nothing to do with the story, and it wasn't even in the script. You know, one of them, you just put an affectionate hand on a shoulder, or you do something, or you take something, you know, get a little crumb on your face, you know, without. And those little moments are often subconscious, and the audience goes, "Okay, I like these people. I don't even know why."
Yeah.
It's like, because they care about each other, and they're taking this relationship seriously. So that was really at the heart of the show. And it's I'm glad people who wanted to see it can see it.
You had a line, Jamie is rolling out something with the rolling pin, like really aggressively. And you say something like, you know, flatter doesn't mean longer or something like that. And it was in the context of her talking about like doing business as an actress and how much business she should do. And I just blurted out, I laughed so hard when you said that, you know, in your very dry way, you would just leaned over like, you know, flatter doesn't mean longer. And she just was, there was, so, I don't know the context of the entire
scene. Helen is a brilliant actress and really funny. And I used to tease her because she was always focused on finding the business. And she was absolutely right. And I learned so much from her.
For people listening, find business. The business means just sort of you're kind of doing some things in the scene if you don't have lines, but you're...
That's what makes it look like life.
Yeah.
Because in real life, you look at a not great sitcom and people are just standing around the couch, you know, throwing one-liners at each other. It's like, I've never stood behind my couch and talked to somebody ever.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what are you doing? And that was, what are we doing? Okay, I'm making breakfast. Okay, I'm putting out the paper. I'm changing, you
brushing
know.
Brushing my hair.
Yeah, looking doing something. I'm looking for my keys. You know, just like, by the way, just that. You know, so what are you actually doing in life? And we used to tease her because she was so busy. She was so committed to doing stuff that I think for the first season, you never saw her face. She was looking, she was bending, she was a blur. We used to call the blonde blurs. Like, where'd she go? She's looking for her keys. Picking up, talking about the pieces of business and acting, they've made a Chinese Mad about you, which is
I wanted to mention Bill Grunfest. I was having drinks with him at the Comedy Cellar, and he's a comedian.
Bill is an old buddy of mine and created the Comedy Cellar here in New York, and he was a writer on Mad About You and producer for many years. So they said, well, we need a consultant. And I said, Billy's the guy. And he went to China and he was overseeing, which is a very tricky thing because, as he was explaining, you know, it's like state run. So it's not, you think you have network
he
notes.
He said that, yeah.
You got government notes.
And the notes are like, it's completely innocuous things here in America that they would fixate on there.
Yeah, because of huge cultural differences. But it was interesting to me, A, that they wanted to do it. And they thought that specifically, as Billy tells it, that one of the main reasons they wanted this show is that because it was pro family, and they felt that if couples are happy, then they won't have time to worry about the government. But I don't know however deeply. But anyway, that they wanted, and it's apparently a huge hit there now.
You literally have brought her out world peace.
You know what? I'm doing my job, but one of the things that struck me. I just saw the pilot, but they did a British version for about 2 years too, where they just took our script, recast it. And I remember Helen and I watched one or two of the episodes that were the British version. This is a couple of years ago, a while back, as while our show was on. And we were just stunned and a little bit irritated that they would do all our business, all the things that we spend all week working out.
Oh,
they just said, we'll do what he did. So he walks to the couch, then he picks up the keys, then he pets the dog. And I went, well, we came up with that. You gotta come up with your own shit. And but that was the hard part. That was the, you know, make it come to life. But that was always, how do we make this look like a real couple and not a TV show? You know, like one of the things that we came up upon, if they were getting undressed. Well, in real life, you're going to get dressed undressed in front of your wife, your husband. In TV, you're not going to get naked, but you don't want to get cute about it. Right? So you're not going to go turn around. So how do you do it? So we'd always have to find some reason. Whatever, you're just walking or talking.
Right.
But if it rang false, it would bring down the show.
Yeah.
Like, well, why is he being prudish in front of his wife? Why is she being uptight? So that principle of really trying to keep them real. And seeming like real people was very much on the front of our minds.
How much of that gets tweaked and fixed and rewrite? You know, I've worked on The Daily Show. I work on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. And there's a rewrite process after rehearsal. I mean, obviously, it's a completely different genre. But the idea is the same of like, it's funny because when the Colbert Report is born out of The Daily Show, and the process is the same. Like, you do the jokes, we rehearse around 4, and then there's a rewrite from like 4 to 4:30 to 5-ish to just, you know, this joke didn't work, whatever, the graphic isn't right. And the union guy who's been at Sullivan Theater forever goes up, what are they doing in that rewrite room anyway? And this guy had been there 30 years. He goes, well, what do you mean? He goes, well, were they rewriting the show? Why are they rewriting the show? They just wrote the show. Well, we're just trying to make it better. Well, maybe they should get a clock down there so we all can get home in a decent hour. Like, that's all they care about are their meal breaks and stuff, right? But my question is sort of, in that process as the week is going on, you have your initial draft and table reads. Where are you? Who is keeping an eye out for that stuff? The genuineness, those real moments.
And it was in the DNA of the show, yeah. You know. And it was, as I said, when Helen and I first sat down and spoke, it was the thing that mattered most to us. And you know, Danny Jacobson, who was my partner and created the show with me, that was. You know, that was also part of it. And it was very tempting. Sometimes a writer would come up with a great joke and would get a big laugh, and we'd have to go, it sounds like a joke.
Yeah.
It sounds like, you know, another type of show.
Yeah.
It sounds like, I mean, you don't want to sacrifice a funny, so you want funny. Mm. But in real life, people don't throw zingers at each other without it either somebody zinging you back or somebody going, ow, asshole, that actually hurts my feeling. So it had to be, we'd always temper it. But we had a director, we had, you know, various directors over the years and several directors over once any season. And one guy came in, it was a visiting director, and he said something that was, it was a compliment to everybody on the show and the writers and producers. And he said, you know, we would, you know, start a script on Monday, read the script, practice, rehearse it, rewrite, and we'd tape it Friday night. And he said, what I admire about the people I'm mad about you is you don't stop till it's right. And and a lot of times you go, okay, the script is fine, shoot it as is. Like, no, if we can make it better, let's make it better.
But don't you think that's informed by you as a stand-up? You said about stand-up, it's refreshing to have the immediacy. It's very low tech. You've talked about recently doing stand-up again. It's not all that much has changed. You still have to do the work. You have to keep making it funnier. And it's the same thing. Yeah. Like one of the blessings and the curse of being a stand-up, I tell people, is the joke's never fucking done.
Never done.
It's never, you can always be better.
One of my favorite movies is Mr. Saturday Night, Billy Crystal's movie.
Yeah.
Which was this beautiful character, which is sort of a conglomeration of a lot of old school comics that we know. And there's a moment where he is, you know, and he has us, he's a comic, this character, and his brother, David Paymer, is his manager, and they have this very fractious, is that a word, relationship, and a lot of love, but a lot of resentment and stuff. And there's a scene where they're, as old men, in the park, in Central Park, and it just, Billy's character, Billy says, I never got the act perfect. And I went, oh my God, I never got the act perfect. It's like, no, you don't.
Yeah.
You never do. And which is a good thing because it's growing. And even if you get it perfect, it'll slip in some other way. You get the words perfect and you'll miss it. So it is, it's the frustration. It's also the thrill, the live wire.
But
act.
That's what made the show great for you, I think.
You brought
that sensibility.
We all were really perfectionists let's get it as good. And we, as I said, we had certain principles that we tried to never violate. Like, well, let's keep it real. You know, I'll stop talking about Mad About You.
No.
But we always would say it's about the little things. And then once in a while, we do a premise, a story that was a really high concept, crazy, wacky thing. Mm. And Helen and I would sort of shrug and look at each other and go, yeah, it's the little things. You're like, oh, we're going on a spaceship. But we never did the spaceship episode. But there was one episode that was really funny. It was, I think it was the first season. Yeah, it was the first season. And it was a virtual reality that my cousin, Johnny Packer, plays my cousin, and he gets me to invest in this new thing. It's a guy, it's this young whiz kid, and he invented a virtual reality. You can go in, you can skydive, you can do this thing. And he takes him, and I, in my virtual, I put it on, and one of the things you could choose was Christie Brinkley will give you a massage. So we got Christie Brinkley, and it's all in this digitized, you know, pixelated little world. And I go home, and so that's a really huge, high concept.
Yeah.
However, the real part of the show was, and the best part of the show was the absolute polar opposite, was that night I go home and I try to talk my wife, Helen Hunt, into, we got to do this investment because it's our money and that's a real thing related. I said, it's unbelievable. You can do anything. I mean, you would love it, honey. You could skydive, you could parachute, you could sing in the opera. It's so real. And she goes, well, I guess, what did you do? I said, I got a massage from Christie Brinkley. And there's a long, really long pause. And the audience, the more she's silent and just looks at me, the laugh just builds. And then she goes, you are a little, little man. And And I thought, well, here's a perfect, there's a quintessential Matt about you, because we actually had a very wacky concept.
Right.
But the funny was, how do you explain this to your wife?
Right.
And how does she hold your feet to the right. fire? And so even when we had big issue, big comedy premises,
it fed a more substantial point.
It always came back to, well, what's going on with these two?
And human nature and everything else. So you were part of an era in comedy, not just a witness, but part of it. That, you know, there was Freddie Prinze and Jimmy Walker, and those guys were sort of predated
a little before me, but
they were sort of set the path to comics having their own sitcoms built around their act.
That was the breadcrumb. That was what's like, oh, if you go to these clubs where these guys came from, apparently you end up with a TV show.
Right. And now the premise for paying comics in the city so little money is, well, your pay is exposure to the industry. An executive from CBS, that's not going to happen. Were they in fact there in the 70s and 80s hanging out looking to discover, or was that a fallacy back then?
No, I saw it increase. You know, it was much more so in LA, I believe, than in New York.
Yeah.
In New York, you would know when somebody was in, hey,
Everybody's talking.
Coming in, there's a new show at ABC, they're looking for funny guys. So, and the club would put up, you know, their 12 guys, and you'd want to be one of the 12. And so you would know it was coming. So, yeah, so they both fed off each other, the clubs and the performers. Yeah, they should have been paid. Yes, we would have all done it for free. Yes, we did all do it for free.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And yeah, we are getting stage time.
Yeah.
And we are getting exposure. On the other hand, you know, you guys are making a lot of money, and we're the hamsters here. So,
a little bit, you
got to feed the hamsters.
Yeah. And so were you very quickly starting to think, okay, what is my show for me? Or
you started to ask before about when did you find your voice? And I don't remember thinking I've got to find my voice. Yeah. I think it just happens, and you do it. When I first went up, I have a cassette somewhere of the first time I went on stage, and I was 18, and it was terrible. I didn't know enough to know that it was terrible. Thank God. It's like, you know.
Well, you would have stopped. We were all terrible when we started.
Right. It's like, you know, like babies can actually swim underwater because, like, they don't know that they're not supposed to. And like, oh, well, as soon as you find out, you're going to hate being in a pool underwater. So, and I listened to it and I go, oh, I was imitating Woody Allen. I was imitating David Brenner. I was Robert Klein, you know, oh, I could hear the pieces of it. And I didn't give myself homework. I didn't say I've got it, but you just do it. And 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, the more years you get under your belt.
Yeah, you need that first few years where you're just so
you're like a lump of clay.
Oh my God, I just got to get through this and be funny with anything. And then you start to not worry about that so much and really start to want to talk about things you want to talk about.
Yeah. And it took a while. And as I said, it sort of happened as I found my area of material. It's like, you know, not that I'm the first or the last at all to talk about, you know, marriage. You know, everybody talks. It's funny. There's a club where we met, the Comedy Magic Club in Hermosa. And, you know, we'll just drop in and, you know, call up and say, can we come down? And any given night, there's, you know, a lot of people want to get on. And Ray Romano was coming down.
Yeah.
And I was coming down. There's a period that we were both just sort of working out. And he came in one night and he saw me. He goes, did you already go on? All right, my knees hurt. Did you do I Gotta Wake Up and Pee a Lot? Shit, okay. Did you do, did you do My Wife That Is Yelling at Me for this? Like, yeah, check. He goes, you and I can never go on the road together.
By the way, that Hermosa, it was nice of you to do this and you were so cool. And you talked about when you and the guys, Jerry and Larry, you were kind of hanging out, and you told that story earlier about sort of just you finished each other. Being in that room at Hermosa Beach, it was you, it was this new guy, Jay Leno, Bobby Collins, like some really substantial people in that room. But it didn't feel like that. It just, like, you guys shooting the shit and you throw stuff around. And I immediately felt like these are guys like that I've idolized and looked up to. And I'm like sitting there and don't say anything stupid and whatever. But you quickly engaged me in conversation and then you started throwing like lines around. It was really
there is that bond. And, you know, if you took the same four people and put them in a, you know, on the street, they wouldn't be there. But in the in the context that you put in a comedy club, where all of us started, and each of us worked that room, you just go back to that square one. Yeah, you're right. And there's Jay, and Gary Shandling, rest in peace. He was when I was going back into it about 3 years ago, and I would see him a lot there too. And he was, great and supportive, and he was able to, he said he was pointing out things that he thought of mine were working and making the same connection. I thought, wow, it's just there. There is a bond and a level that comics relate to each other, which is really kind of special.
Why did you stop doing it for quite a while?
I didn't. It wasn't a conscious decision. I just got distracted. It was exactly when Mad About You, I just got busy. And then Mad About You was really full time, And there were guys that were able to do a show and still do the stand-up. Jerry did his stand-up. I think Ray was doing his stand-up.
John Stewart stopped. It was just too much.
Yeah. But I don't know that John ever really wanted to be a stand-up so much as, talk about finding your voice. And it's like, wow, there's a guy. And it took, 10, 15 years when suddenly John Stewart became John Stewart.
Plus the show had already existed for 3.5 years.
Yeah, but even him, I think, on the other side of 9/11, suddenly emerged through the fire and like, now you're John Stewart.
Yeah.
And it takes a long time. I had a quick short story. I did about 10 years ago, 10, 12 years ago, I did a Woody Allen play here in New York. And it was an evening, two one-acts that he wrote and he directed. And he had never directed theater.
Right.
So it was like a 99-seat theater and no money. And but it was like, I'm going to get to work with Woody Allen.
It's called Writer's Block.
Writer's Block. Yeah. And the joy of it was, working and doing Woody Allen play, but the real joy was, for rehearsals and in previews, Woody would be there, and then he'd sit and he'd give you thoughts, and he would be rewriting constantly. So to watch him do that, and I remember there was one night he came backstage, the other fellow in the play, Skip Suddeth, very funny, talented actor, we look at each other and go, do you believe this shit? Look at us.
Pinching yourself,
two knuckleheads, and we're getting notes from Woody Allen. Oh, my God. Life has worked out
nicely.
It had
to be like that when you had Mel Brooks on.
Oh, for sure. Right? Every all the time. Yeah. But there was a night when Woody Allen came back and he goes, and he talked. And people say, what is Woody Allen like? I said, Woody Allen reminds you of every guy that reminds you of Woody Allen. Because you've met a dozen people go, he's like a Woody Allen, but this guy is that guy.
It's so many people have done an impression of him. When you meet him, you probably go, that's not a very good impression of yourself.
It's over the top. But anyway, he was stymied that one joke didn't work. He goes, I don't understand. I don't do good Woody Allen. He said, but I got a laugh yesterday. He goes, why would it not get a laugh today? And I said, how long have you been doing this? I said, it's never the same. He goes, no, but they laughed yesterday. Why wouldn't they laugh? And I was really heartened. Like, okay.
Everybody.
Yeah. Even when you're Woody Allen and you're 70 or something at this point and still going, not only can I not fix the line, I don't get why it didn't work.
Right.
I said, this is an endless, joyful journey.
There's 1,000 people in the theater and two aren't laughing and you're fixated on that.
Yeah. Why is that?
I got to get you out of here, unfortunately. But we got to. So maybe when I come to LA, I'll get you again.
We'll do it again. We'll do page two.
The diner. We got to talk about diner. You got the Smothers Brothers project, which I'm fascinated
by. No, that's out. Cross that out. That's old. That has been dead for a long time.
All right, okay. But
I'm doing this show now on Amazon, Red Oaks.
Let's talk about that.
Red Oaks, you can watch it on Amazon if you get to figure out how to work the Amazon thing, get a child to explain it.
You put quarters into the side of the TV and stuff comes up, right?
And it's a really fun. It's really
you play Getty.
I play this guy who's the head of a country club. It's like 1985. And it's a coming of age piece. This young guy, Craig Roberts, plays this 20-year-old who's out of college. Richard Kind plays his father, and he doesn't know what he wants to do with his future. And he wants to be a filmmaker, but he doesn't quite know how to go about it. And he's taking the last hurrah. He's working as a tennis pro at this country, or a junior tennis pro at this country club. And I am this Wall Street heavy guy, who is the president of the country club and big fish in a very tiny pond.
Yeah.
And I get to play a bit of a prick, and it's really
which
fun.
Which is nice, because you're always known as the nice guy, and you're kind of...
Yeah, but I worked with a buddy of mine, and we were writing this thing that I was going to do. He said, everybody thinks of you as such a nice guy. You're not that nice. And I went, I know. I know.
I've been duping the world
for years.
It's
so fun. So that's been a lot of fun. And so anyway, so you can watch the first season. That we're about to, next week, we start filming the second season, and it'll be out in the fall of this year.
Steven really Soderbergh, you had said the people involved attracted you to it. You read the script.
It was a great script by Greg Jacobs, who was Steven Soderbergh's assistant director and producer for years. And I had done one day on the movie that they did about with Michael Douglas and Matt Damon, the Liberace story, the Candelabra. And I think somehow from there he went, well, maybe we can get Paul to do this. And it was a really great script. It was a fun role. And then the people, you know, Richard Kind, who I know for years on Mad About You, is so funny.
Yeah.
And Jennifer Grey and Gina Gershon. And then a bunch of young actors that I did not know who were so great. It's Craig Roberts and this Canadian actor named Ennis Esmer Oliver Cooper, really funny, and it's really a sweet movie. And it's not like a sitcom. It's really, it's a comedy, but it's a lot of heart, and it's almost like a movie. You know, that's the thing now when you watch on Amazon or Netflix, these, you know, binge watch something, it's really like a movie, a 10-hour movie split up into little pieces.
Yeah, it's like House of Cards. I've binge watched that thing.
Yeah.
Real quick before you go, multicam, which was Mad About You with a studio audience.
Yeah.
Single cam now, which is what you're working in now on Amazon. How are those rhythms different for you as an actor and I won't say producer writer because you're not really doing
it. It's interesting. I actually, when we did Mad About You, I wanted it to be a single camera, and there were very few. There was like 30 something. I wasn't really
I could see it being one, but what was your instinct?
I had my experience before that, having done a little bit of other multicams, I felt that they were trying too hard to get the audience, and it was all about the woo. It's like, well, that's not real, you know. And again, in Mad About You, we're trying to make
it's about those small moments,
right? So it was in the beginning, it was confused. Ultimately, I think I'm glad we went with the audience, and they do tell you when they laugh. But a lot of times, if they don't laugh, the temptation might be, oh, the joke is wrong, the line is wrong. But in your head, you have to know, well, they're not laughing because they don't see what we're going to see. It's going to be cut on a camera. We're going to cut from here, cut to that, or we'll see a close-up, or we're going to put a little music, whatever it is. You have to think simultaneously for the audience that's there, but more importantly for the audience that's later going to be there watching on TV. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, that is the audience. The audience is who's watching at home.
Right.
It's not the 107 people in the crowd who can be, you know, you throw them, you know, a smelt and they'll jump up and down and they'll laugh.
Right.
Or they think they're supposed to.
Right.
You know, I actually used to go to the crowd. It would make me crazy if there was a tender moment in Mad About You and, you know, or we kiss or we say something sweet in the audience. Just because they heard it on other shows, the audience would go, aww. And I would go, okay, we got to stop. Okay, I love you all. Can't do that. This is there's no people in our house saying, aw, that's sweet. So you can't do that. When you're home watching it, you can do that. But don't do it here. And we would pull it out. Sometimes we just leave it in, but we take it out of the audio when we produce because it broke the wall to me, and it made it false.
Yeah.
So it is a different sensibility, but I mean, I only think of single camera now. I couldn't really imagine myself doing a multicam because it's too tempting to fall into bad habits.
Yeah.
And listen, there are great shows. You know, Chuck Lorre is a genius, and he's writing great shows, and they're great audience pleasers. But for me, I like the world of Red Oaks, and I like the world where you can simultaneously alternate between funny and less funny.
And be entertained and relate to it at the same time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, this was great fun,
thank
man.
You so much for being on. Big honor.
We'll have to come back and we'll do it in L.A. We'll do year two of my
year
career.
Year two. We're going to do like a 15-part series. Paul Reiser, Mad About You. You can get them all the seasons.
All
now.
The seasons, every music cue.
Red Oaks, Amazon, where you can see him be a prick, finally. The world's been waiting. And thank you so much for doing this.
Pleasure, man. Thank you.